Previously on Beta.
Today's big craze is all these people walking around catching all these little digital creatures.
And all that sweat was coming out. My accordion was sweaty. I was sweaty. I kept going.
Why is everyone going under their desks? That's when I found out about earthquake drills. Apparently, Utah sits on this fault line where at any point in time, we're just supposed to have this huge, disastrous earthquake on here.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, blogger Heather Armstrong talks about her deep depression and the lengths she went to battle it.
And they have to get me to a point where I'm breathing again. And of course, my mother is watching this whole thing happen and she's waiting, waiting, waiting. Is she going to breathe? Is she going to breathe?
Also, Ankur Malhotra on his quest to preserve traditional Indian folk music.
But there was no music from India. We are the second largest country in the world, population-wise, country which is rich and steeped in culture and musical culture specifically. And this was kind of, why isn't it there?
But first, science fiction novelist Neal Stephenson. He's the author of best-selling science fiction thrillers Seven Eves, Snow Crash, and Cryptonomicon. Neal's latest novel is called Fall, or Dodge in Hell. It's been described as Paradise Lost by way of Philip K. Dick.
It's an idea that's been on my mind for a little while. I've always been interested in John Milton's Paradise Lost. I kind of brushed up against that topic a little bit when I was working on the Baroque cycle, which takes place during the era that Milton was active. And I just had on my mind for a while the idea of trying to go there, except do it in a modern kind of digital science fictional kind of way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You said in an interview that your books usually start with you asking yourself the question, hey, wouldn't it be a great yarn if? Is that a question that you asked yourself when you started working on this novel?
Yeah, I think the yarn here is that someone suddenly dies and has his loved ones discover that years ago he signed an unusual last will and testament giving directions that he was supposed to be frozen and brought back to life when that became technologically possible. And it was a thing that he did kind of on a whim and forgot about it. But now it's still a binding document and they have to figure out a way to carry out his wishes. And because he's become a very wealthy individual in the meantime, they have a kind of unlimited resources with which to do that.
So can you give us kind of a Cliff's Notes-style outline of the storyline of Fall without revealing any or, at the very least, too many spoilers?
Well, I've already spoiled one thing,
yeah.
Which is that Dodge passes away pretty early in the book. It's a surprise. It's one of these unexpected medical problems that pops up out of nowhere. And so his family is left to find a way to carry out his wishes. It leads to him being brought back to life, not in a physical, biological sense, but as a digital upload into the cloud. But as so often happens with these things, it doesn't all go as planned. And so it leads to kind of the creation of a whole sort of digital afterlife that's occupied not only by the original character, Dodge, but by many other people who decide that they want to have the same treatment for themselves.
Now would be a great time to have you read an excerpt, and you're welcome to set it up if you'd like.
Sure. This is shortly after Dodge has passed away, and the whole problem has been dumped into the lap of a friend of his named Corvallis Kawasaki, or C or C plus, or his nicknames. And he's in a conversation with a somewhat weird tech guy who gets drawn into the story named Elmo Shepard, who's obsessed with this notion of scanning people's brains and bringing them back. And so he's in the middle of a conversation with L in a bar in Seattle. Corvallis took a sip of his beer. It was good. He wondered if there was beer in L Shepard's digital heaven. "You're probably looking at ion beam scanning," L said. Yes. This was the new technique Corvallis had alluded to earlier, the one Wobbsey was using on mouse brains. The family conference in the hotel suite hadn't felt like the right time or place to delve into its technical details. If you bought into the proposition, which L. Shepard apparently did, that the connectome was all there was to the human brain, that once you had created a digital record of the wiring diagram and stored that in the cloud, you could throw away what was left of the body and not lose anything that mattered, then ion beam scanning appeared to be the answer. The older technique used on the 11 Afreda cryonics brains had been to run them through what amounted to a high-precision bologna slicer, cutting away the thinnest possible layers one at a time and photographing what had been thus exposed, and then repeating the process, then trying to trace the connections as they angled across the photographic layers. This was the hard problem that Wobbsey had attempted to gamify a couple of years ago. It was only as good as the thinness of the bologna slicing, the resolution of the photographs, and the attention span of the gamers. Ion beam scanning destroyed the brain a few molecules at a time in order to save it. A beam of charged particles focused to subcellular precision burned away the brain tissue. But as it did so, it was gathering information about what it was destroying and storing it to a much higher resolution than could be attained using the older technique. In its essentials, it was the same as bologna slicing. It just worked at higher precision. Instead of a heap of paper-thin brain slices, the physical residue was smoke and steam, a higher form of cremation. "Look," Corvallis said, "as far as I am concerned, as a nerd who has read about it on the internet, yes, of course, way better than running it through a deli slicer and taking pictures." "I would go further," L said, "and say that once we have it up and running, we are done here. Even if we did later invent a higher resolution system, it would serve no additional purpose. It would be like making a map of the United States at sub-millimeter scale, no better than a map done at centimeter scale."
You have this great ability to predict the future of technology in your fiction. The metaverse and Snow Crash is probably the best example. So I'm wondering, do you think that this idea of humans existing in the afterlife as digital souls is really something that will or could become reality?
Well, I think you're being pretty kind in your assessment of my future predicting abilities. So we could delve into that maybe at another time.
Okay.
You know, this is a case where I'm stepping back a little bit from trying to be too technically precise in the science part of it. Mm-hmm. So if you look, for example, at my previous novel, Seven Eves, in that book, I am going to some efforts to try to be sort of precise and do calculations and make it be realistic as far as the orbital mechanics and so on is concerned. But in the case of Fall, notwithstanding the bit I just read, which sounds pretty technical,
yeah,
I'm really not trying to go there because there are so many unknowns connected with how the brain works, what consciousness is, whether you could actually bring a mind back to life. So this is one of those cases where I'm just going for it. I'm just saying, let's say for the sake of storytelling that this could be done. Let's just accept that as a premise and let's see where it takes us.
Yeah. So correct me if I'm wrong, but this is kind of a different sort of book from your other books in the sense that it's not as technically precise because you're taking on a more ambitious and creative idea. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. I mean, it's one thing to write science fiction about the trajectory of a rocket ship, but it's a completely different domain when we start getting into, you know, what is consciousness, what does it mean to have a soul and all that. Mm-hmm. So we just have to go to a more kind of relaxed and easygoing style of treating the science.
One of the big questions, and you've alluded to it already, one of the big questions that your book raises is how can we really know what is going on inside of another mind, whether it's a biological brain or a digital simulation? What do you think the answer to that is?
Well, part of what's going on there is a little bit of me trying to make a good story, right?
Uh-huh. So
it makes for a better story if there's not a lot of direct communication between the world of the living, which we call meat space in the book,
yeah,
and bit world. Because if they're just talking to each other, then it sort of removes a lot of the potential for interest and drama in the story. So what I'm saying is that there's just such a basic disconnect between the realities that these two kinds of people live in, the physically embodied consciousness here in our world and the digital world, that they just don't have an obvious way to communicate. And the digital souls, if you want to call them that, are only dimly aware that there might be another world that they came from.
One of the things that really struck me while reading Fall is just how long your scenes go on. So many of them seem to contain clear beginnings, middles, and ends. They feel very much like real life. Is that an intentional move on your part?
I mean, my cadence of writing tends to be that I get up and I sort of have my coffee and sit down and write for a couple of hours. And so the amount of material I can write in that time is kind of maybe a natural unit.
Yeah.
Of size. So that may be what you're seeing in that case.
You started out as a physics major at the University of Boston, but then you switched to geography. So I'm wondering, is there a connection between majoring in geography and just how detailed and richly textured the sense of place is in the story worlds that you build in your novels?
I believe there is. I mean, I've always been fascinated by maps and landforms and, you know, why the world is shaped and hooked up the way it is. So that's been an ongoing topic of interest to me my whole life. When I made that change during college, one of the things that sort of pushed me into it was that I was taking a cartography class, which was part of the geography department. So we were making maps, and they had a graphics terminal. It was the sort of the first computer graphics terminal I had ever had access to and been able to play around with and write code for. And so it was very primitive by today's standards, of course, but it was kind of incredible to me that I could sit and write code that would cause pictures to appear on a screen. Hmm. So I've continued that interest since then, and in ReamD, when we learn about the background of Dodge's video game company and some of the people who work there, we learn about, for example, a character named Pluto, who is the landforms expert. He's kind of almost like a proxy for me in a way, mm-hmm. the nerd who sits around and thinks about what mountains should look like. And that carries over pretty directly into Fall. Except that instead of just making a video game landscape, they end up building what amounts to a very real landscape for digital souls to live in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You said that you tend to invent a whole different system for writing each book. Was that the case for this one, for Fall?
In the case of Fall, it's all just making stuff up. And so the amount of research was quite minimal, and it was really just me sitting down for a couple of hours every morning and telling the story.
Mm-hmm. Was that a nice change for you, not to have to do so much research and just let your imagination run wild and not have to be so tethered to reality?
I am happy either way. I actually find that being tethered, I don't think of it as being tethered to reality when I am doing a more research-based book,
mm-hmm.
because reality provides all kinds of useful ideas for characters and storylines and plot events. And so it actually, I think, makes it easier to do a more research-driven book than something like this, where I'm just kind of sitting there having to pull everything out of my head.
Yeah, so did that mean because of that you were, as you say, having to sitting there pulling everything out of your head, did you have to do more revisions for Fall than you've had to for your previous novels?
A little bit, but maybe not in the way you're thinking. There's a section early on about a, I don't want to call it a prank, but it's a hoax perpetrated on
yes.
the internet on an enormous scale. At the time I wrote it, which was probably 2015, early 2016, I was really patting myself on the back for being way ahead of the curve and wearing that kind of future predicting hat. And then what I and a lot of other science fiction writers found out late in 2016 was that we were way behind.
Hmm.
We had no idea. So I had to go back in the wake of that and rethink that section a little bit and sort of recast it, not as wow, here's an incredibly weird hypothetical thing that might happen in the future, and more as, you know, here's kind of a metaphor or a framework for thinking about what actually did happen.
I want to run one of my favorite quotes about writing by you. This is from Don DeLillo. Quote, "The sentences I am working on generate the ideas that tend to lead to more sentences," end quote. Is that the case for you?
Interesting quote. I'll say that I feel as though I do my best work when I'm writing longhand with a fountain pen. I think there's something about seeing the sentence emerge in a sort of natural cadence on the page that does lead to the next sentence and the next. And there's a really interesting thing that happens almost every day when I stop and I walk away, and then for about 15 minutes, other sentences will come into my head. And so I've learned, I used to carry a little pocket tape recorder around. Now I just use a voice recorder on my phone. But I've learned to keep that handy because a lot of those phrases and sentences that pop into my head after I've stopped for the day are the ones I'm kind of most proud of.
Neal Stephenson is the author of Fall or Dodge in Hell. You can find out more about Neal on our website, wpr.org/beta.
We ended up actually setting up a vinyl cutting lathe in India, and now, you know, we are the only people in India making records.
Ankur Malhotra tells us why he spends so much time in his homeland of India. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Ankur Malhotra splits his time between Wisconsin and New Delhi, India, where he runs Amorous Records. It's an independent record label that produces vinyl releases from a range of international artists with a strong focus on preserving traditional Indian folk music. Beta producer Carl Christensen sat down with Ankur to talk about his time searching for ancient musical masters and what his relationship to music was growing up in India in the early 1980s.
I was kind of very close to it. You know, something that you listen to all the time. It kind of surrounds you. You know, you go to the market and it's playing, blaring out of a radio and things like that. And, you know, I can credit my father with kind of instilling that joy, because he would be listening to a lot of the Bollywood, classic Bollywood stuff from 50s, 60s, 70s. I don't know how I got my hands on his record player, you know, when I was not even into my double digits, and access to his you know, collection of records, which also included a lot of esoteric stuff. You know, there was the Bollywood stuff, but also psychedelic Western soundtracks and stuff like that. And those are the sounds that have kind of been ricocheting in my brain ever since, and kind of been around.
So you eventually move to Wisconsin, you get your MBA at UW-Madison, and then what brings you back to India to find these masters of traditional Indian folk music, such as Laka Khan?
It was a couple of things that were going on at that time. Part of it was I was by this time living in the States and fully immersed in the local community and kind of volunteering both on radio and with the community festivals and so forth. And as I was kind of getting immersed in the space, one of those things that kind of became more evident and more telling was, and I was watching a lot of music and listening to a lot of music from all over the world, but there was no music from India. We are the second largest country in the world, population-wise, country which is rich and steeped in culture and, you know, musical culture specifically. And this was kind of, you know, why isn't it there? And, you know, one day I was chatting with my longtime friend, Ashutosh Sharma, who's co-founder with Amorous Records. And, you know, we're joking about we can't find the blues, you know, as to paraphrase that famous phrase. And then, you know, one day listening to some of these records, we were thinking about, you know, who are the Indian bluesmen, you know, who are the Indian folk stars. And we really couldn't come up with names. And that for us was, well, a matter of shame, but it was also a eureka moment because we knew they were out there. So it became a kind of a, oh, well, what if we go out to find them? And that became the beginning, and we kind of presented this first concert in Delhi in 2010. And we had these 40 musicians, master musicians on stage, a fabulous, massive production, the Manganyar Seduction. And at the end of it, they all again kind of disappeared into the sand. And for us, that was like, well, who are these people? What are their names? Where does this music come from? And that became the driver. And actually, a week after that concert, we just got into the car and drove into the desert. There were, I think, 5 villages, 40, 50 musicians we met on that first trip in December 2010. And towards the end of that trip, we're driving back and, you know, there's Laka Khan, this master musician, plays the Sindhi Sarangi, a 26-string Indian folk instrument. And, you know, we show up at his home late in the evening and, you know, he decides to play us a couple of songs. And once you hear the sound of the Sarangi and once you hear Laka Khan singing, you know, there's this raw, powerful voice, but there's also this melancholy. He's the 7th generation master musician of this instrument, and perhaps the last. And that weighed heavy on him because, you know, his sons didn't pick up the instrument when we first met him. You know, one son was driving a truck, another son was working as a laborer. So, you know, he was the last in how many generations, and then the music stopped there. And that kind of explains some of the deep sadness and melancholy that's so evident in his music. What will I leave behind?
You mentioned this pressure that Laka Khan feels to pass along these musical traditions. Do you feel a similar pressure to preserve this music?
Yes, there is this kind of unrelenting pressure, you know, just like Laka Khan feels that perhaps is he the last one. And for us also, it was kind of more driven by the fact that realizing that, yes, indeed, these are some of those last great players of these sounds. And if that music is not recorded, it's going to be lost forever because Laka Khan and a lot of the folk music from India comes from an oral tradition. Most of it has never been recorded. It's a treasure trove, and that would get lost forever if it was not being recorded. We also recorded some other master musicians, some of them no longer with us today. One of them was the late Rukma Bai, one of the very few female singers from this community of musicians, the Manganyars from Rajasthan. She was struck with polio at a young age, so she didn't have her legs. So she didn't have both her legs, yet she had been performing all her life. And so we were at her village in Barmer, about 40 kilometers from the Pakistan border, close to this other state of Gujarat, crossroads of trade for centuries. Some people say the Romas, the gypsies, kind of all evolved from here thousands of years ago. And while we're recording her, she shouts out to this man walking down the village street, "Mangya." "Bring your harmonium and accompany me on this track," or something. And so this man you know, accompanies her, and we finish recording, and it's about 8:30 at night, December. It's dark already. And we're about to pack up when Mangya, this harmonium player, pipes up and says, I also sing, may I? And we're like, sure. And he starts singing. And we both have goosebumps down our arms. That was the voice of Manga, the voice of Barmer Boys, the band that we know today. But then, I think 2017, we ended up actually setting up a vinyl cutting lathe in India. And now, you know, we are the only people in India making records. So for a country of 1.3 billion, there is one record cutting machine active in a tiny corner in the outskirts of Delhi, run by Amaris Records.
Okay, so you're cutting these records, these vinyl records, by hand of traditional Indian folk music. What has been the reaction so far in India?
I would say it has been very well received. Of course, it was a struggle to begin with. It still is to this day. But we've been successful in bringing audiences. Like, case in point would be Barmer Boys, where some of their first shows, we'd have, you know, a few dozen people in the audience. And our first big break came in 2014 when we were booked to play Roskilde Festival in Denmark. And the best part was our set was sandwiched between sets by Outkast and the Rolling Stones. Also describing what we are trying to accomplish at Amaris is how do we bring this music to new audiences, but how do we also explore new, perhaps uncharted territory, you know, musically speaking. And case in point would be Lakha Khan, a sarangi player, collaborating with Madhu Siddiqui Diabate, another master musician, 71st generation Kora player, the African lute harp, a 20-string instrument. Forty-seven strings, speaking with each other. The musicians don't know each other's language.
So you split your time between Madison and India, and most of the artists on your label are from India or some from Africa. So what keeps you in Wisconsin?
Madison is a beautiful town. You know, I've been here 20 years, and it's such a fabulous community. You know, I could be living in a big city, and I lived in a big city. I'm a Delhiite. And then we're in the beautiful outdoors and nature and you know, Black Earth Creek. I love fly fishing and things like that. Just, you know, step away, and 30 minutes later, you're enjoying beautiful outdoors of the state. It's such a beautiful, welcoming culture and accepting, and that's been one of those things which has kept me here.
Running an independent record label, do you find it hard to balance the artistic, musical stuff with all the business stuff?
Balance. What's that? No, it has been a tough juggling act, also spanning continents. You know, it's a DIY label, and so I guess we signed up for it. There's the work-life balance, but then there's also this balancing act within the record label trying to run the business. One of the other pressing things is that these musicians aren't getting any younger. someone like Laka Khan probably has 400, 500 songs in his songbook, all in his head. And as a fact, I know his sons know only probably 20% of those songs. So, you know, Laka Khan has been touring with us, has been on the road, but he's not getting younger. And there's going to be a point pretty much in the near future where, you know, he's going to stop touring. Is that an end of a livelihood? Is that the end of the music? And for Amaras, we feel that there is still more that can be done. So if that transfer doesn't happen or is not made, or, you know, we kind of don't take efforts to capture some of this music or record it, it's going to be lost forever.
Encore Malhotra talked about his independent record label, Amaras Records, with Beta producer Carl Christensen. Find out more about his label and Encore on our website, wpr.org/beta.
I experienced music and light and color in a way that I had not ever experienced before, almost like I had been reborn.
Heather Armstrong on the experimental way she treated her depression. That's coming up next. I'm Doug Gordon, and this is Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and you're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. For blogger and author Heather Armstrong, life seemed perfect, at least on her popular mommy blog, Deuce. She presented as the picture of modern motherhood to her legions of readers. Then she found herself in the depths of depression she couldn't shake. In her book, The Valedictorian of Being Dead, Heather shares the lengths she'd go to battle her hopelessness. She says living a very public life while dealing with despair was surreal.
I think it was the expectation from my audience saying, well, you know, you've shared all of this, now you need to share everything else. And it wasn't what I wanted to share, and it was my own story that I wanted to keep secret, and people were very angry at me, and they took that anger out on me because I wouldn't talk about it.
That must have been really tough to deal with, having to deal with all that anger.
To read about your divorce on the New York Times or the Huffington Post and the local newspaper is really strange.
Yeah, really surreal, I imagine. On your darkest days, what kinds of thoughts were running through your mind?
I was on, I called it the hamster wheel, where I was doing everything over and over and over and over again with no end in sight and no joy and no reward and no happiness. And although I loved my children, I felt like what I was doing is providing basic needs, and I felt helpless because I couldn't keep up with it all.
Did your thoughts get dark enough that you were ever thinking about suicide?
I had suicidal thoughts in the sense that I just wanted to be dead. Mm-hmm. I never planned anything, and I never had a way in mind of ending my life, mm-hmm. but I just really longed for the lack of my senses, for like a sense of nothingness. Mm-hmm. But there was one moment that overcame me and scared me so badly, and that's when I called my mother.
Yeah, can you tell me about that moment?
Well, so I've been calling my mother almost nightly for 18 months and just sort of screaming into the phone that I just couldn't keep up anymore, and it just went on and on and on. And then there was this moment where I had been dating in Utah for 6 months, which is, Utah is a beautiful backdrop for a suicidal ideation, is what I write. Mm-hmm. This person left my house in a fit, and I remember falling to the floor and feeling a very dark feeling overcome me. Mm-hmm. And that dark feeling was so scary that I knew I needed to reach out to someone.
Mm-hmm. So you reached out to your mom.
And then I did.
Yeah, and then what happened? What did you tell her, and what did she do?
I just started howling and wailing into the phone, and she knew with the tone in my voice that she needed to drive to my house. And so she said, you're going to stay on the phone with me, and you're going to be there when I get there, and I'm going to talk to you the whole time. And so I stayed on the phone, and when I answered the door, she was on the phone, and I was on the phone.
And wasn't it her idea? Wasn't one of the things she said the next morning that she forced you to make an appointment with your psychiatrist?
She did force me. I needed to get a refill on a prescription, but I was very afraid to see my psychiatrist because I was afraid that he might commit me, which was a very scary thought because I didn't want to lose custody of my kids. And I sat down across from him, and he looked at me and just shook his head. He says, you don't have to say a word. I know exactly what you're feeling. The depression has stolen your eyes. Uh-huh. And he came back over and he said, listen, you know I run the ECT clinic, which is electroconvulsive therapy. And what we're doing is trying to replicate the effects of ECT without the side effects, which are permanent memory loss, migraines, and other sorts of maladies that can occur when you get ECT. Uh-huh. And we can do that through anesthesia, which has no side effects. And they have decided to use propofol to take the brain down to a certain, basically, I called it a flat line, but it really is sort of a flat line because it goes down to a flat line, then there's a burst, a flat line and a burst, and it's called burst suppression.
Can you take me through the first treatment?
Yeah, we walked into the clinic and I filled out a piece of paperwork that asked me all sorts of questions about how I felt about myself and about life. And I wanted to throw that piece of paper in the garbage because it's like, I don't want to tell them. Yeah. I don't want to write about this.
Yeah.
I feel terrible about myself. And they, you know, and then there's a needle that they have to stick in your arm. And they were getting used to the needle, which is much larger than the normal needle that they use for ECT. And then we would sit in the waiting room until they called me in. Mm-hmm. And they'd walk me over to a gurney, affix a wire to my forehead, and then they'd shove me the propofol, and they would stick me under. And unfortunately, the first time that they put me under, they also gave me fentanyl, which apparently I'm allergic to.
Oh, dear.
So I had a very, very bad hallucination going under. Oh, yeah.
Can you tell me just a bit about the hallucination? What did you imagine that you were seeing?
Immediately, they said that you should be able to feel the fentanyl right now. And as they said that, their voices melted, and then the walls started melting.
Oh, wow.
And then the room started melting, and then everybody in the room turned into a monster, and like they were about to attack me and eat me.
Ooh.
It was not a good trip.
No. How long were you out for?
So I went down, and they kept me at the burst suppression state for about 15 to 18 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And then they waited for me to come back up. And that first time, it took almost 2 hours for me to come back up.
Oh, wow.
And they have to get me to a point where I'm breathing again. And, of course, my mother is watching this whole thing happen. And she's waiting, waiting, waiting. Is she going to breathe? Is she going to breathe?
Yeah.
So it was harrowing for her.
So how did you feel when you after those 2 hours, when you came back up? How did you feel?
I had a terrible, terrible headache, a searing, searing headache from the fentanyl. And I was very discouraged. I thought, okay, this is not going to work. There's no way I can do this. I can't live like this. And so we went back to them the second time and said, can we not use that?
Hmm.
So they were able to take that out of the dosage.
Okay, and so that made a difference. You didn't
yes.
hallucinate. You didn't get bad headaches. And I would
exactly.
And was it also the case that they didn't have as much trouble bringing you back?
Exactly.
Yeah. Your mother. Yeah. You mentioned about your mother watching you that first time and waiting for you to start breathing again. And 2 hours. That must have been just really excruciating. Your mother and stepfather accompanied you to every treatment. What did they tell you about what it was like to watch you going through this 10 times in less than a month?
It was so much harder on my mother than it was on me.
Mm-hmm.
And it was extraordinarily harrowing for my mother to watch it every single time. And my mother never sat down My mother never sat down during the entire time I was out. Oh, wow. She watched and watched, and she would talk to the doctors and she would talk to the nurses and take notes and take pictures. And she's the star of the book. She's the star of the whole story. Mm. She is, people tell me that if it was made into a movie, she would be the leading role.
When did you realize that the treatment was working?
Well, sometimes when you're depressed, you don't realize you're feeling better.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't think I was feeling better, but I had started to shower.
Yeah.
I had started to put on makeup after the second or third treatment. I had started to put on clean clothes. And then after the fifth treatment, I came home and I didn't feel drowsy or groggy. And I experienced music and light and color in a way that I had not ever experienced before.
Oh,
almost
really?
Almost like I had been reborn.
Oh, yeah. Wow. So even you'd never even experienced this even before this major depressive episode.
It was so much deeper and richer and full of just contrast. And it was such a remarkable change that I really did have the idea in my head, like, I can't believe that I could have possibly wanted to be dead yesterday.
Wow. And then you continued to feel that way through the remaining five treatments?
Yeah. And I was scared that maybe the treatment would reverse what I had just experienced. And he's like, no, this is only supposed to get better with each, you know, continuing treatment. And when it was over, I was just gloriously happy.
That's wonderful.
And remain so.
That's great, yeah. After you completed all 10 sessions, you found out something interesting about the medical staff who had treated you. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, well, so it turns out that this is a clinical trial, and they had literally no money going into this initial 10 people. And so all of the people at the clinic were donating their time.
Wow.
They were staying after for however long it took me to wake up out of that anesthesia and giving me themselves to get me better. And I am forever indebted to those people who donated their time to my mental health.
You interviewed Dr. Mickey after the treatment. Was he able to explain to you how the treatment worked?
Yeah, so the idea, there was a study done in Austria in the early 1990s, and they thought, okay, they studied ECT, and they realized that in ECT, they shock the brain to a seizure, and the seizure can cause a flat line in the brain, a temporary flat line for a couple of minutes. And that flat line is what sort of reboots the computer of the brain.
Mm.
And they did a study that found out if you didn't have the flat line after the seizure, you didn't get any benefit from the ECT. And then they thought, well, what if you can do this with anesthesia? Why not try that?
Mm-hmm.
So they did a study with anesthesia and achieved the same results. And so the staff and the community, the medical community in Utah is incredible. And they are looking for ways always to improve mental health especially. And they looked into this and thought, why are we not pursuing this?
Mm.
So this is like one of the primary, it's only being done here in the world.
Mm.
It's being done here at the University
oh, wow.
of Utah.
Yeah. How has the treatment worked for the other people who have received it?
So this is 10 people, and they came up with the study, and this is the first time propofol has ever been used this way. And they just had this idea, well, propofol can cause this in the brain, burst suppression. And of the 10, 6 of us experienced positive results.
That's great.
Which is remarkable for, you know, something they just came up with.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah, it's been 2 years. And, you know, I have my bad days,
mm-hmm.
of course, and I have my anxious moments. But my brain is now at a point where I can recognize that it's just an anxious moment. It's a bad day.
That's fantastic.
It's not the end of the world.
What do you want readers to get out of your book, The Valedictorian of Being Dead?
I want people to have the words that they may not be able to come up with themselves,
mm-hmm.
to explain to other people, this is what it feels like to be anxious. This is what it feels like to be depressed. This is what is going through my head. Please understand and please believe me. And for people who aren't depressed, who aren't anxious, to understand, oh, this is what my wife is going through. This is what my daughter is going through. I wanted to give words to people who didn't have them.
Mm, yeah. And what did you get out of writing your memoir?
I really wanted to write a book because I wanted to bring attention to this study. I didn't think a blog post or a magazine article would do it. I think people needed something in their hands to hold. And for me, it gave me a new purpose in life. Mm-hmm. I really do believe that my calling is to bring awareness and to bring a voice to this so that other people feel safer talking and reaching out about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How has it changed your relationship with your daughters, Lita and Marlo, and your mother and stepfather and your siblings?
We have really grown close as a family, and you know, a lot of the grandchildren suffer, and I think what I have done is given my brother and sister hope for their kids. Mm-hmm. And my two daughters, they wanted me to be happy. That's really all they wanted, was to see me happy again, and we're so happy that I returned to them in clean clothes.
Yeah.
And and we have very, very open and frank conversations about anxiety and sadness and bad days. Mm. So
suicide is a pretty big public health problem in Utah. Do you have any thoughts about why that's the case?
It's a huge health problem.
Yeah.
I think we have one of the highest teen suicide rates in the country, if not the highest. My brother's son went to a high school last year that had 6 suicides.
Wow.
Yeah. And they do a lot of research into like the fact that altitude has a problem with exacerbating depression. But I think that the research should probably go more into social media. Mm-hmm. And should go into cultural pressure, religious pressure. A lot of it is that these kids are trying to live up to a standard that they feel like they can't meet. Mm. And this is a phenomenon. This is a tragedy that we have to address.
Heather Armstrong is the creator of the popular blog Deuce and author of The Valedictorian of Being Dead. You can find out more about Heather at WPR.org/beta.
As we move into the world of integral, computerized knowledge, mere classification becomes secondary and inadequate to the speeds with which data can now be processed. We are moving out of the world of data classification into the world of pattern recognition.
Tedium. It's the dull side of the internet.
You've got mail.
You probably know the expression, innovate or die. Well, it turns out you can innovate and die. Tedium's Ernie Smith is here to tell us how the funeral industry is breathing new life into paying tribute to our departed loved ones.
At the end of 2015, there were two fairly well-known rock stars that passed. One was Scott Weiland, the lead singer of Stone Temple Pilots for a number of years. And the other was Lemmy Kilmister, the frontman of Motorhead.
You know I'm going to lose, and gambling's for fools, but that's the way I like it, baby, I don't want to live forever.
And the one thing that the two of them had in common is that they both used the same company to make their urns, the families of both of those rock stars. This company called Foreverence, what they do is they will custom build an urn using 3D printing technology, so that you can have something that's very specifically designed to reflect that person's personality.
Right.
In the case of Weiland, they basically created a megaphone for him. It was something that Weiland was known to use on stage a lot. So,
I see.
So they kind of did that. In the case of Lemmy, they created this custom thing that was sort of recreation of his hat and also featured some of his iconography, notably the Ace of Spades, which is one of Motorhead's best-known songs.
And the same company, Foreverence, really stepped up their game for the urn that they created for Prince after he passed. Can you tell me about that?
Yes, they actually made a model recreation of Paisley Park, which is actually located inside of Paisley Park. It's a very beautiful design. Clearly a lot of work and a lot of love went into that design. It definitely does not fit the definition of what most people would consider an urn.
That's interesting. Assuming that the singularity doesn't happen and you are not able to live forever, Ernie, what kind of cutting-edge technology would you choose to commemorate your demise?
I personally find what Foreverence is doing to be very cool, because I think that one of the things that we have really embraced is this idea of customization. We want to be able to live our lives in our own custom way. We want to have personalized things.
Ernie Smith is the editor of Tedium. You can find out more about Ernie and Tedium on our website, wpr.org/beta. That does it for this edition of Beta. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta podcast via iTunes or wherever you catch your favorite pods. And make sure to let us know what you think by leaving a rating or a comment. You can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta or on Twitter at @WPRBeta. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
You don't sell the steak, you sell the sizzle.
The show is put together by Steve Gotcher and Adam Friedrich.
Adam and Eve, and not Adam and Steve.
Special thanks to our producer, Carl Christensen.
Ooh, hey, Carl, this is pretty boss, man.
And thanks to you, our alphas. Until next week, I'm Doug Gordon.
You're in purgatory, Doug. Spin the wheel of reincarnation.